I could still hear all kinds of crunching and stuff, and I don't know what it. I don't know what it is.
I am very sorry.
It's just
sorry.
Like scrunch, crunch, 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 crunch. I don't know what it is. It's a sweat. Are you wearing a sweater?
It could be my
your beard.
Oh. It could be my beard.
You bearded wonder. Now what are we gonna do?
I will have to hold my microphone away from my face a little bit.
Or that's maybe you're touching. Are you touching your beard too?
No.
You're just
no.
You're like scratching it with a mic.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
How about that?
Mystery solved. Okay. Well, now I won't hear it so much. But I was like, what is all that sound? Yes, whiskers. That's what it was. Just whiskers.
That's what it was.
I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast.
Welcome to Spark My Muse, everyone. Today, my guest is Gene Stevenson. He is a fellow nerd and someone I met in graduate school. Thanks, Gene, for being my guest today.
Thanks for having me, Lisa.
So what I thought we would do today is, because this episode will be happening and be released between Christmas and New Year's, I thought we could take a little time to do something more interesting. We're going to talk about Stranger Things. We're going to talk about sort of lighter topics maybe than I usually do. But before we get started, I hope, Gene, that you can introduce yourself to my listeners.
Sure. I'm currently sitting in the offices of Religious and Theological Abstracts, of which I'm the executive director here in Myerstown, Pennsylvania. And it's an organization, a nonprofit organization that's been around for 60 years now, and their primary purpose is to write and compile summaries of academic journal articles in the fields of religion and theology. They were kind of on the cutting edge. They're pioneers in this work, we're working to bring it into the 21st century, to continue to improve it and keep up with the technology and that kind of a thing. So that's the paying gig, as they say.
Yeah, when I went there recently to see what you're up to and how many journals that you summarize within what you're doing, it's really handy because you can go online and just search something and then find the abstracts, and you don't have to look and read every single article to find out what it's about first. And if that doesn't qualify you as a nerd's nerd, I don't know what would.
It's a very niche market. Yeah. We'll put it that way.
Yeah. And it's really cool because it can save you tons of time. Like for academics, you don't have to go find each journal article and read through it. You can get the nutshell version and then decide, is it worth it to pursue that article or buy that journal online or find it in print? And is it worth it? Yeah. So it's actually a huge time saver.
Yes. Yeah. And I was actually introduced to the tool when I was a graduate student here at Evangelical. Mm-hmm. And I just found it fascinating. I mean, we had certain assignments, mm-hmm. that we were supposed to go out and find journal articles on a particular topic, and it was just an invaluable tool to help me decide what to go after. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, how many journals do you end up covering at this point?
Overall, we cover over 700. I want to say it's pushing 800 journals. Now, of those, ooh, there's a good many that have either changed their title name or have ceased publication altogether. So what we'd like to say is the number of active current journals that we abstract is more along the lines of 450 to 500.
That's quite a number, though, quite a high number.
It is a lot, yeah. but you have to remember, Religious and Theological Abstracts, it covers religion and theology as broadly as you can consider that. Now, we do target academic journals, mm-hmm. But the topics of religion and theology are vast. Mm. So, yeah.
Yeah, so it's Jewish studies and Buddhist studies, and all those are included within that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Yep.
That's awesome. Yeah. Now, do you guys have good marketing? Like, do people know you're out there?
That's something that we're working on. I mean, they do, especially if they have been some of our faithful subscribers for years, and most of our subscribers are libraries, yeah, are universities. You can get an individual subscription, but really it's the institutional subscriptions that, mm-hmm, that are really our target area.
Yeah.
So, if they've been with us, they know of us.
Mm-hmm.
We're one of a handful of groups in the world that to do what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you Google religious abstracting, we're top of the list. So,
Because I noticed when I went there, the online component's nice too. If you're not close to a library or something where you,
yes,
could pick up that you could just go online, pay for a subscription, and just, search to your heart's content. You could find whatever you needed. And it's just, yeah, super handy. And I don't think I realized the depth of what you guys did while I was doing all those research favors.
Yeah.
And that would have saved me more time than I, would have,
yeah,
realized.
Yeah.
Cause the kind of rigorous papers we did in school, now that I'm teaching graduate school right now, there's a lot of whining, and I'm not requiring anywhere near the kind of rigor that we would, where,
right,
I would turn in a paper, right, there would be 88 citations in a 30 page paper or something.
Right. Well, one of the things that I've found helpful is when you talk about an academic tool like RNTA, it's very easy to get into kind of the clinical language of academic journals and, mm-hmm, abstracting and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And put a more, I don't know if practical is the right word, but familiar feel to it. What we're really doing is we're kind of exposing people to the dialogues that have been going on for decades in these fields. And so it really is, we kind of see ourselves as a gateway to those conversations. I think putting it in those kinds of terms, it's a little more comforting, warm and comforting.
Exactly. It's accessible, and I think that's right. It's a bridge to all those different places you can go. And for people who are very curious and want to explore, I mean, it's just exciting, I think, more than daunting or, oh no, there's 450 things out there.
Right.
Well, it's really interesting work. And I think, and then who would think it was in Meyerstown happening in Meyerstown.
Meyerstown's where the magic happens. I grew up in Meyerstown, so it's one of these places, a very small town, but right around the corner you find one of these worldwide industries right in your backyard. So
yeah,
it's kind of interesting.
That's wonderful. Well, how did the opportunity come for you to work there?
Well, it was towards the end of my studies here at Evangelical. In fact, I think I might have already graduated, and RNTA actually sent out a job posting, mm-hmm, through the denominational kind of email chain, and it might have even been the seminary family, the seminary email chain, and they were looking more for an office assistant.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew of them from having used the service with my graduate studies. So I said, I'm just going to send in my resume. It was kind of on a whim.
Huh.
I was looking to pick up some part-time work at the time. And they called me in for an interview and said, well, this is more than what we were looking for. but sure, you got the job. So my official title starting out was contributing editor. And I pretty much did whatever they needed me to do. And then just kind of grew into the company and started doing more. And I took over as executive director October of 2015.
That's really neat.
Yeah.
Well, because we're in this season of Christmas time and New Year's and around the holidays, I wanted to make sure I was able to ask you from your point of view. We took a lot of classes together, and most of those classes, I think, were spiritual formation and theology classes. I don't know exactly how many. It was at least three, but maybe more than that, plenty more.
Yeah.
It's starting to become a blur to me. But
yeah.
And I wanted to see what are some of the things you do to become more mindful in this time of year, this season? And what are some things that have been meaningful for you?
One of the things that's always been meaningful for me around this time of year, I'm a big fan of A Christmas Carol, of Dickens' Christmas Carol. It's one of my favorite Christmas messages. I kind of look at it as almost like a regular Christmas sermon that I have to hear. I have to experience that story at some point in time around this time of year. And I think every time I do, I gain something more from it. It's a familiar story, but just the idea that especially relevant, actually continually relevant, almost disturbingly so, the idea that we can get so caught up in the material world, the material aspects of this life, that the real intangibles and recognizing and working to meet the needs of other people can get lost. And that's, it always kind of pulls me back to what's really important and what's really real whenever I sit down and just kind of let myself be immersed in that world again. I've kind of made it a habit of looking for different expressions of this story. So as many different movie versions as you can think of, I've probably seen them. I probably own some of them, but just to see the different takes on that very same message, that's one of the things that I always go to at this time of year.
Including the Muppets.
Including the Muppets. Gotta have the Muppets.
Right. I love them. Yeah, it's interesting too. I this falls under the scope of theopoetics, thinking of how art can embody in a special way, in a different way than propositional theology, can embody truth and the things we need to hear that are the sacred things and the meaningful things that strike something different in us that go beyond words. And that's kind of what you're talking about too, that sinking deeply into the arts like performance or literature, it does something different to us. It changes us more deeply and helps us to connect to each other and to somehow embody those messages differently. And I'm with you on that too. It's whether it's poetry or theater or something, there's something else going on that you won't. Maybe you'll get the same thing in a sermon message or in some propositions, but probably I won't get the same thing than experiencing something more full-bodied.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's an aspect of theology that very much that can very much feed the intellect, and that's not a bad thing, but to really go after the soul, which is quite often beyond our ability to express. Like you have to experience it. You have to soak it in. I think it's kind of necessary to balance out all the heady mental intellectual stuff that we tend to get when we talk about theology.
As we're talking about some of those themes at that time of year, I'm noticing too, the segue is obvious to me that in Stranger Things, season 2 ends at the snowball dance.
Yes.
At that time of year. And we were going to talk a little bit about Stranger Things and some of those themes and the cultural connections there. And so tell me a little bit about how you found out about Stranger Things. Were you a fan from the start, or what was your introduction to it?
I was a fan from the start. It happened. I have this, once we put the kids to bed and everything, and we're kind of winding down, I'll often pick up my Kindle and just see what's on Netflix. So I was laying there in bed getting ready to watch whatever, and I just saw it come up. It was, I think, it was brand new at the time. I'm like, oh, this looks interesting. Hadn't heard anything about it. Mm-hmm. So I clicked on it and started watching. And of course, it sucked me in. Yeah. And I was just like, just from the kid in me was squeeing as I'm seeing, the 80s culture that I remember, and just the kids, you know, mm-hmm. kind of living in that world. I'm like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's how I got sucked in right away. And then later on, a couple months down the road, the same thing happened with my wife when I told her, look, you've got to watch this.
Yeah.
This is great. And she's like, all right, I'll give it a shot. She mm-hmm. wasn't as enthused about it.
Mm-hmm.
She watched the first episode and she's like, I got to know what happens now. So
I
converted my wife to being a Stranger Things fan.
Well, for me, I had heard everybody talking about it, and that's usually why I don't tune into things. I'm like, oh, please.
Right.
Yeah. And then I saw they got an award. I don't know what it was for. They got some award, and then Winona Ryder was like hilarious accepting this award.
Yes.
And she had all these different faces, and I was like, good for Winona Ryder. She's back on the scene. Like, I was happy to see her back, and I noticed like other 80s people making cameos, and I was like, this is really sounds cool. But also, was it like it sounded dumb to me or something? I didn't care. And I was tuned out, and then for the first season, and I wasn't getting on the hype train or anything. And then the second season came out, and I think almost all of it was done. And, you know, I heard people talking about just going crazy about it and how much, you know, oh, it's so great. And I was holding it at arm's length. And then something just piqued my interest one day. And then I watched the first episode, and I was immediately hooked. And I was like, mm-hmm. oh, this is like E.T. Like, I just kept thinking, had all these hat tips to all these 80s movies and...
Yeah.
And I loved that they were doing that they were paying homage to these different 80s like themes and cultural icons and movies. And I was like, oh, I see what they're doing here. And there's all these kids who will not understand that at all.
Yeah.
I'm on Twitter, and there was this like person who posted, oh my God, do you realize that the Stranger Things kids must be in their 40s now? And I'm thinking, yeah, that I was one of the Stranger Things kids. I had the Trapper Keeper.
Right.
I wouldn't have been one of the Dungeons & Dragons kids because we were fundamentalists, but but I knew all of them. And it was just so funny because that's my childhood. That's how we rolled. We didn't have telephones that we carried with us. And I thought, what was interesting to me about it, too, was that the kids were solving their own problems, and also the parents weren't set up as dupes, or they made mistakes and they weren't perfect, but they also weren't against the kids, or I don't know, usually the parents play a role in movies that really makes them shallow and like really one-dimensional characters. Either they're, the set up as bad guys, or they're set up as fools, or they're very minor roles. And what was neat in this is that they were just as well developed as the kids were.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was, that's part of the appeal, is that there are no real shallow characters in this, no throwaway characters in the series, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. And so, what were some of the themes that appealed to you and caused you to think more deeply about it instead of just thinking of it as just entertainment?
Well, one of the things that was actually mentioned in that awards speech, the David Harbour, the actor who plays Hopper, that I really, maybe I felt more than I actually thought about while I was watching the series, was how it really is about kind of outcasts finding community together, which... When I heard the speech and I thought about it, he's right. He's really right. And that, of course, resonates with me. I was not ever in my school, my grade school days, in any kind of in crowd. So that really appealed to me personally. But, you know, theologically, there's an appeal there, too, because isn't that kind of what we are as the church? You know, it's not a beauty pageant. You don't belong because you've proven yourself to be perfect or beautiful or anything like this. You belong because of a savior that embraces you, kind of warts and all. And that's, you know, there's an appeal there.
Some of the things in Stranger Things appeal to me as well, where the odds are so, so overwhelming, and there's no way that anyone can do it alone. And then you keep thinking, oh, well, maybe they'll have a reprieve. And it's like, nope, the odds keep getting worse.
Right.
Yeah. And they keep persevering. Like when he's stuck in that place, there's no way to find him or have any idea what's going on. Like there's so long into the season.
Yeah.
And she's just, the mom's just this crazy person with these lights and she has no idea, but she doesn't lose faith. It's like there's an unseen world. She doesn't lose faith. But everybody's going to think she's out of her mind and she's got lights up there, you know? And there's such an interesting parallel to, you know, what are we supposed to do when there's unexplainable things that make us seem crazy, but yet they're also real.
Yeah.
And you need a couple people to believe you. endearing that, you know, how they played that out.
Yeah, and one of the things that I found really interesting and I think is a lesson that I as a father need to take into heart, but even as a society, even as a church, really need to pay attention to is the fact that the kids in the story have a better grasp on that unseen world and can actually articulate it better than the adults do. And it's actually in both seasons, I think, the kids play a key role in explaining, in putting into words what's happening as this unseen world infiltrates the seen world. And that's really thought-provoking. That's really potent, I think.
Now, is this something that you wind up watching with your wife and then talking about later? Or is it just like you wind up kind of mulling it over in your mind and thinking about after you're done watching it?
Definitely a little bit of both. I think my wife's now done with season two, so yeah, as she's watching it, you know, we're talking about it. In both cases, both seasons, I finished it before she did. So it was she always wants to ply me with questions as she's watching it. Well, does this character survive? What happens with this? And you know, I gotta kind of like, no, you gotta watch it. You gotta watch it.
Yeah, and I think when they're willing to do really bold things and take out characters that you wind up getting attached to, that's pretty risky. And that also makes you love it even more, but it's very bittersweet. You know, you're thinking anybody could go at any minute. You know, I've grown accustomed to, and I hope they don't go, then you could lose them. It's interesting how they've chosen to do that. And you know, all good stories are really actually like that. In a way, you want the character to continue, but it makes for a better story when you lose them. So it's fascinating what makes for a good story.
Yeah, and there's I don't know how sensitive we want to be to spoilers or whatnot, but there is a particular character in season two that makes a grand sacrifice, that's a really jarring but also kind of satisfying moment in season two. So
I think it's, and when that happens in story, you're right, the satisfying feeling that of course it's a loss and you're like, oh, how are we going to make it without this character now, because they had big shoulders, they were taking on a lot, like emotionally, for some of the other characters. At the same time, you want them to be brave, and that means something, like that their sacrifice meant something, and for some reason like you knew it had to happen. There's a really funny thing that happens in stories where there's sacrifice, like same with the Lord of the Rings and some of the different really epic stories where you don't want it to happen because you want the character to continue, but the sacrifice makes that story a classic. And it's really interesting that part of myth that carries on, the stories that last always do that, it seems.
Yeah, and I think as we're enjoying these stories, there's something in us that instinctively recognizes that sacrifice, like that self-sacrifice, is itself meaningful, that it bestows meaning on that character or purpose for that character, even as that character is, even as we're losing that character, as the character is exiting the story through this sacrifice, it bestows almost a holy purpose on them. Mm-hmm. And we kind of, maybe I should just speak for myself, I'm kind of instinctively drawn to that. I recognize that there's something real there, something real taking place. So
yeah, something powerful. And yeah, I totally agree with that. It's hard to even put words around all of the feelings that it elicits, but yeah, and I'm wondering what direction they'll go in now season 3, because they've done a lot with it so far, so they might have to go in a very different direction.
Well, apparently they've got plans, so I don't know.
I don't doubt it. Yeah, and maybe since you've seen some episodes of Dark, we could talk about it a little bit. For people who don't know, because that's much less popular than Stranger Things, for people who don't know what Dark is, I think of it as a little bit like Stranger Things, but more adult. It's definitely got the swear words in there and some nudity and stuff. Unlike Stranger Things, it's much more like a PG-14. Mm-hmm. This would be for adults. And then there's the parts like that it's like Stranger Things is that there's like disappearances of people, and there's some, it's a thriller mystery, but it's also like Looper, so there's all this time traveling going on. And yeah, it really makes for interesting twists. It's like a Mobius strip, because you're not sure how all these different time periods interrelate and how many times people are maybe looping back and forth, or and who's who. And so the way they trickle out the mystery is also just really genius, I thought, where you get, there's like two or three big reveals in each episode that'll like blow your mind and turn it completely around. So you're like, what? No, that person's related to this person with this thing. And it'll be like these huge twists. And I really thought that it's well written in those ways. And what was your sense, Gene?
Yeah, the thing I like about Dark is I really could get heady and intellectual.
go for it.
We really could go there. I think one of the things that becomes very evident as you watch Dark is that one of the themes that goes through the series is how much we impact one another, not just temporarily, but long term. One of the things that you see, even as this mystery is unraveling, you have this kind of sci-fi element, is that's one of the themes, that all these characters who are involved in this small town, they're all kind of involved in each other's lives, have impacted one another for better or worse. And that's, you know, that's convicting. Intimidating, because then it starts to get you to wonder about, well, you know, the people I come in contact with on a regular basis, what might I be contributing to them positively or negatively? Are TV shows supposed to make us think this?
I don't know, but I like that.
Yeah.
That's my favorite. Yeah. Well, with Dark, there's more of a, I wouldn't say, well, it's a sci-fi-ish thing, because they're talking about time travel, black holes, and the future impacting the present and the past, which is, you know, that's quantum physics. And so it's not really, you know, like my daughter was like, well, is that even true? And it's like, actually, they're talking about this. This is kind of a math thing. It's not something I can wrap my brain around, but that time experienced in a linear fashion is how we experience it, but it doesn't mean that's actually how it is.
Yeah.
So it does really make you think, you know, wormholes seem like they're these, you know, potentially impossible things, but it's time isn't like we're experiencing it. It can have, you know, we know it changes shape. It's, you know, can be changed by gravity, and you know, mm-hmm. that's proven now with those gravitational waves that they found. And so there's a lot there that show is really, really twisting with time a lot. And yeah. it doesn't mean like you'll walk into a cave and suddenly come out in another time period. But at the same time, there's still things that you have to wonder about that we don't understand all things about time. And we don't know how much of what we're doing has an impact. And so it gives you pause about how much are we affecting each other.
Yeah, I find it really interesting that in these stories, the theory, I mean, there's some practical relevance to the theory. So for me, I don't have a problem entertaining the idea of a multiverse, mm-hmm. That there are multiple timelines going on. I think that's kind of, I don't know that we sense it, but we think that way whenever we play the game with ourselves, which is kind of a dangerous game. What would, where would I be right now if I had made X choice instead of Y choice?
Yeah.
We kind of, our minds kind of take us in those places. Mm-hmm. But with these series, it's not so much that part. That part's kind of practical. It's kind of almost natural, if you want to say it that way, for us to think that way. These series always deal with, well, could we potentially get from where we are to over there, you know, to one of those alternative timelines or whatnot, which is kind of a good thing and a dangerous thing. I mean, it's good because as humans, we want to explore. Mm-hmm. So we want to explore, like, what would life be like over there? But it can also feed our, this kind of desire that we have to escape mm-hmm. the world that we are in right now, which there are limits to the healthy benefits of escape, I think.
Well, it also, by the same token, it makes you really realize how much agency, if you will, you have, or that your actions matter. So, like, you know, in different wars, like the Civil War, even the World War II, you know, World War II, the Germans were winning a lot of that war effort. And if things had gone another way, if London had been taken over, which they were doing a great job bombing London and mm-hmm. could have easily taken over, could have, it was up for grabs for a while, London. And if they had taken over London, if they had been able to get into Russia, things might be a lot different. And same with the Civil War. The South was winning for quite a while. What if they had, you know, and you wind up thinking, wow, you know, individuals made certain sacrifices, did certain actions, decided to attack this way instead of that way. You know, Normandy happened. So changing the way the war went, and you think, you know, there were some real pivot points. And mm-hmm. if those hadn't happened, you know, I might not be talking to you right now, for one thing. You know, we don't really know, because so many actions affected other actions. And when you start thinking of it like that, and I also wind up thinking about multiverses too, are out there exists, it seems, you know, every possible option that could exist potentially is, you know, one of the theories like that. So when you think, well, I should, you know, someone should do something about that. Well, I'm somebody, you know, and it just seems like, well, should we wait around to see how things work out, or should we make sure that we do the thing that we hope propels the future toward a certain end? Like, if we're upset about the poor, the hungry, should we do something, or should we just talk about doing something?
Right.
You know, it does matter, I think, what we do in this world and in this day.
And that, you know, kind of brings us back to A Christmas Carol. And one of the moments that I think is really profound is the conversation between Scrooge and Marley, where Marley's saying, you know, if I had known, or if I had been more aware, I would have done more while I was alive. And in certain film versions of the story, there's this really profound image of these ghosts of wealthy, self-involved people who are trying to throw their money at an actual poor family that's out in the street. And obviously they can't do anything now because they're passed. And of course, that's one of the main points of A Christmas Carol, is to get Scrooge to kind of open his heart a little bit more Or a lot more.
Yeah, Dickens was time traveling first. He was trying to make that work with his own devices. And I think it's, you know, playing with that idea that is so interesting that humans can do this, and we can play the what ifs in our brain with our level of consciousness, and we can say, we can plan, and we can say what if, and we can play out the different scenarios in our minds until we land on something that seems equitable or seems fair or seems to be for the greatest good. And that is now whether we decide to do that or not, of course, is another thing. But the part about staying true to those things and to those values and using our level of consciousness in those ways. And that's why it's so interesting to encounter this kind of art and this kind of material, because it puts those things back into the front of our minds again.
Yeah. And it reminds us that taking those steps means that we have to kind of subsume our desire for comfort. We have to understand that this is part of why we are here on this earth, is not to be comfortable and 100% secure in our day-to-day lives. It is to give of ourselves. And that means we're going to be a little uncomfortable at times. It means, or at least, that comfort shouldn't be our number one priority.
I think it also brings to mind, like you were talking about sacrifice, and we sort of admire sacrifice in the stories we watch, and that we should be attuned in our own story, in our own lives, to also take those opportunities for certain sacrifice that comes along and on our path and our story. Like, here's an opportunity for sacrifice, but am I going to take it? Or, you know, it doesn't mean that we have to sacrifice everything constantly all the time, but there are points where maybe I should be that person that I admire in the story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this has been really fun, and it went by kind of fast.
It did.
So hopefully I can have you back on and we can talk deeply about some other things, and film or movies or Netflix or something like that. I've had a lot of fun.
I'm always up for it.
Now, if people want to get in touch with you in some way and ask you a question, where's a good place to reach you?
If they're interested in religious and theological abstracts, they can check out our website, www.rtabstracts.org. Mm-hmm. And there should be some contact information on the website there. If they're interested in chatting movies or talking with me personally, they can look me up on Facebook or email me, genesteve@yahoo.com.
This is great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lisa.
If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned, or a book, or a website, that's what show notes are for. Patreon is like patron with an E. Patreon.com/SparkMyMuse. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.